My name is Charlie Post. I'll be chairing this session, which has been strangely titled Expropriation and Appropriation Beyond the Wage Form, but really is sort of different sort of perspectives on slavery, particularly in the New World. Our first presentation is going to be by Kevin Anderson, the author of Marx and the Margins, and who teaches at UC Santa Barbara, who's going to talk on Marx, on the Civil War, and slavery. He's then going to be followed by Eric Lott from the University of Virginia, who will be talking about slavery in Capital. And I assume because that's italicized, he's referring to the book rather than the social relation. And then finally, John Clegg, who is in transition from being a graduate school student here at the New School to NYU, is going to talk about the wages of slavery, a value theoretic model of slave prices. Hopefully the presentations will run no more total than 45 minutes to an hour, and then we will be able to have some questions and answers and discussion. So, Kevin.
Hi. I'm going to talk about Marx on race and slavery, mainly in the United States, but also a little bit about ancient Rome. These are non-systematic considerations. I was informed I was giving this paper about 2 days ago. I think a lot of people are aware of Marx's writings during the Civil War, collected in a volume called Marx and Engels on the Civil War in the United States, and a lot of it just been republished in a volume of by Robin Blackburn. It's just off the press now. But Marx's concern with African slavery in the Americas goes back really to the beginning of his war. It isn't mentioned in the Communist Manifesto, but 2 years before, in what's known as the Letter to Anemko, he writes the following. This is one of the early statements of what people call one of the early statements of historical materialism. Direct slavery is as much the pivot upon which our present-day industrialism turns as our machinery, industry, credit, etc. Without slavery, there would be no cotton. Without cotton, there would be no modern industry. It is slavery which is giving value to the colonies. It is the colonies which have created world trade, and world trade is the necessary condition for large-scale machine industry. Slavery is therefore an economic category of paramount importance. So that's like very early on, 1846. And then, as probably most of you know, the longest period of paid employment Marx ever had was working for the Tribune, the New York Tribune, which was fairly progressive, a daily newspaper, certainly much more outspoken politically than the New York Times, for instance. I know it's called a liberal paper and so on, but it was a kind of liberalism that was stronger, perhaps, liberalism against reaction and authoritarianism than what passes today for liberalism. But I just want to read part of a story, not that Marx didn't write, but it's about the anti-slavery movement in the United States. I just want to read that after a minute. But this is about something called the Oberlin Wellington Rescue, which is in 1858, a famous incident in Ohio in terms of the anti-slavery movement. John Price, a young man, a fugitive slave living in Oberlin, Ohio, was captured by federal agents because the Federal Fugitive Slave Act was in effect. Speared out of town, was waiting at the next town with a railroad junction to be transported south by federal marshals. Well, in Oberlin, crowds gathered, and this is reported by R, because when you see the content of the R, who I think we get a sense of why he or she did not want the full name used. People drove their horses and wagons 10 miles from Oberlin to Wellington, where this young man of 19 or 20 years old was being held. They recaptured him from the federal marshals, brought him back to Oberlin, so here's the report of the return to Oberlin, this 10-mile. The whole line of our return was triumphal. Nearly every farmhouse had emptied, occupants cheering us, blessing us, so forth. Went back to Oberlin, held a rally, cheers for liberty, and then took an oath that basically said, well, here, I'll just truncate. it was voted with deafening unanimity that whoever laid hands on a black man in this community, no matter what the color of his authority, would do so at the peril of his life. If the occasion comes, it will be seen that this is no empty talk. Woe to the slaveholder or marshal that comes prowling about Oberlin. Hereafter, the fugitive cannot be taken from here. This was headlined in the Tribune, and it wasn't an editorial in opinion, this was a news article. And the headline was Kidnapping at Oberlin, the people excited. The kidnapping refers to the federal arrest of John Price. So I'm not saying the Tribune was always as good as that. There were a lot of other kinds of things they had. But it, when you look at that, it's not so shocking that they would have Karl Marx as one of their writers. As we know, I think a lot of us, Marx saluted the John Brown's John Brown led uprising at Harper's Ferry of let's say West Virginia, writing to Engels, the most momentous thing happening in the world today is on the one hand the movement among the slaves in America started by the death of Brown, and then also refers to the unrest of serfs in Russia at that time. Continues, I've just seen in the Tribune that there was a new slave uprising in Missouri, naturally suppressed, but the signal has now been given. He probably thought that it would be a signal for some kind of larger scale slave uprising, which of course we know didn't occur, but he's also probably referring to the kind of tensions that were leading soon to the Civil War. Elsewhere in his Civil War writings, or his writings on race and slavery in America, Marx talks about the poor whites of the South being manipulated. It's a common theme, false conscience. He doesn't use that term, but it's what later came to be called false conscience in the Marxist lexicon. So the slaveholding South it insisted on expansion into new territories, he argues, because it was only by such expansion, as well as the aggression involved in this process, that the interests of a small minority of slave owners could be squared with those of the vast population of poor whites. This was accomplished by giving the poor whites, as he puts it, turbulent impulses for action in an innocuous direction, and to tame them with the prospect of themselves one becoming slaveholders. So keeping them busy with the struggle, of course, which happened in the Civil War itself. Also, the holding out the promise that they would get a piece of the action. Maybe they were poor whites in the old territory, but in the new territory, they might be able to acquire land and slaves. And there's a lot of different ways that he talks about that kind of thing. Probably the part that he devotes the most attention to space-wise in his Civil War writings is actually about British labor, the support of a lot of British meetings held by British workers against intervention in the North, because there was a lot of talk, in public at least, of intervention on the side of the South. The Union put up a naval blockade around the southern ports from the beginning. The cotton wasn't coming to England. That plunged the manufacturing districts of England into a depression until they could get cotton going from Egypt a few years later. And so there were these large meetings held. Now, we now know from secret British cabinet minutes that it never was seriously contemplated military intervention, but people didn't know that at the time. At the time, there was a real fear of that, and also there were people who were really pushing for that. And so there were a lot of mass meetings that were held, and Marx attended some of them. Oh, it's a myth that Marx helped organize these meetings. He didn't have anything to do with organizing them, but he did attend some of them and report on them. And these were not just working class meetings. Liberal politicians spoke at them. Representatives of the manufacturers, the cotton manufacturers, spoke too, because they were liberals for the most part. They were not Tories. They were liberals, and they too supported the end of slavery, and they too said things like, even if it hurts our business, we don't want to be involved in supporting slavery in the United States. But here's Marx's account this actually isn't his account, sorry. This is part of the minutes of one of those meetings. So it's not his report, but just to give a sense of some of the language that was being used by British workers. This is the resolution. It's kind of addressed to the United States. You have struck off the shackles from the poor slaves of the District of Columbia. You have welcomed as men, as equals under God, the colored peoples of Haiti and Liberia, referring to the fact that the U.S. had just finally gotten around to recognizing Haitian independence. And by your Emancipation Proclamation, you have opened the gates of freedom to millions of our Negro brothers who have been deprived of their manhood by the infernal laws which have so long disgraced the civilization of America. Note that, like, disgrace the civilization of America, but they have a great admiration overall. So these dudes, as a flaw, are in a country that they regard as the most progressive of the time. And then there's the penultimate paragraph talking about their own economic interests. Be assured that in following out this noble course, our earnest, our active sympathies will be with you, that like our brothers in Lancashire, the manufacturing district, we would rather perish than band ourselves in an unholy alliance with the South and with slavery. Marx was not involved in organizing these meetings, but he was closely connected to some of the people who were, and it was out of the networks of these anti-slavery meetings, in part, that the First International was founded a year later in 1864, a year after the meeting. In fact, the meeting that founds the First International takes place in the same auditorium where these big anti-slavery meetings and pro-North meetings used to take place. Okay. Agency of African Americans for their own liberation within the Civil War also, so not only in that one incident with the John Brown and Harper's Ferry, but there's a statement in the middle of the Civil War, but fairly early on, saying that a single black regiment would have a remarkable effect upon Southern nerves. That's in a letter to Engels, but very aware of that kind of issue from the beginning. And then this isn't just letters, occasional articles, it works its way into Capital. There's the very well-known passage in Volume 1 of Capital, was published just after the Civil War, that in the United States of America, every independent workers' movement was paralyzed as long as slavery disfigured a part of the Republic. And note that it's a disfiguring, but it's not a wholesale condemnation of the United States, because the fact that the United States is a republic, I mean, this is one of the things the workers are interested in defending. This is the only large-scale republic, as limited as it was at the time. Those workers who were attending those meetings didn't have voting rights in Britain. Then the famous sentence in Capital, labor in a white skin cannot emancipate itself where it is branded in a black skin. I don't know any of the one-volume anthologies of Marx where they excerpt Capital where they ever include that passage. But less known is in the introduction or preface to Capital, where he refers to that in 1776 kind of preceded 1789, and so therefore the American Civil War may precede some radical revolutions in the rest of the world, and refers to a radical change in the existing relations between capital and labor, and capital and landed property, and refers to Benjamin Wade, who was in line to become president, had Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial been successful. And Wade was one of those 40 acres and a mule people. So had that impeachment gone through, possibly some of those more radical changes in property relations would have occurred. But of course, Marx always writes that there was a big change in property relations that we don't even think about today because we live in a pretty much non-slavery world. He constantly refers to the Emancipation Proclamation as one of the largest, maybe the largest expropriations of private property in human history. Okay. I want to also just very briefly mention ancient Rome. He doesn't write a lot about that, but toward the end of his life, there's notebooks devoted to ancient Rome, which are unpublished. And there's a letter of 1877 to Russians about capital where he makes the same reference. What it basically is that when Marx was concerned, as he thought about Rome, with the Gracchi and the, in other words, the attempted empowerment of the Roman plebeians and proletarians, and he was also concerned with the slave revolts and a lot of other things, but those are two things he talked about a lot. So he was very interested in I think it's the second century before the Common Era. There's a number of slave revolts. The Spartacus revolt is actually later, but there's another other major slave revolt. And there's also the Gracchi, for a couple decades, are mobilizing the Roman proletarians against the aristocracy. And so he writes about the difficulties that these two groups had getting together and united. And he agrees with the political economist Sismondi that the true proletariat of Rome was the slave, and what was called the proletariat actually lived off of the slaves, especially later on. But in the middle of talking about how the plebeians never reunite with the slaves because they looked down on the slaves and so forth, he just substantiates these poor whites, he calls them, which is of course the exact language he uses when he talks about the American South. Now Marx never makes a systematic analysis of slavery, but I think throughout his career there's discussion of slavery from 1846 all the way to 1879, that notebook I was quoting from at the end of his life. Slaves, one point is that seeing slaves as kind of a sub-proletariat, certainly being interested in agency, resistance, revolution from slave populations. The notion of a slave status versus that of a free citizen or worker and the tensions that produces and the difficulty that creates for revolution and change, whether in Rome or the United States. And don't forget, you know, in those amendments, those post-Reconstruction amendments, it says race, color, creed, and former slave status, previous condition of servitude. Because we think of it too much in this country in terms of race and ethnicity, which is certainly very important, but slave status, having had slave status or being descended from people who did have slave status, is a status, that's a status issue in many, many cultures, including our own. And of course, overcoming that kind of divide, when the free workers and the enslaved workers can unite, overcome that divide, that can open up revolutionary possibilities. So those are some of the issues Marx wrestles with in different ways throughout his life.